After its sixth nuclear weapons test, North Korea is promising more gift packages for the United States if the U.S. continues its reckless provocations. So how should the U.S. respond to this? We will talk with two guests with different perspectives, and we will welcome your questions and views, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Our first guest is Vikram Singh, Vice President for National Security and International Policy for the Center for American Progress. He served in the Defense Department as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia. He worked in the State Department as the Deputy Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he co-authored the recent piece, Don't Let Trump Start a War with North Korea. Good morning. And I'll make sure that we can hear you by pushing the right button. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. All right, so North Korea claimed to have tested a hydrogen bomb over the weekend, a very powerful one, and told the United States that more gift packages are on the way if we keep up with our reckless provocations. Let's start with a basic question. How big of a threat is North Korea?
I mean, I think North Korea is probably one of the biggest threats to peace and stability in the Asia Pacific, and potentially one of the biggest threats to the United States. I mean, it's the fact is there has really not been a provocation from the United States per se. This is basically being in a way to secure preventive deterrence. He wants to make sure under no uncertain terms that he's got the capacity to strike back if we were to ever decide to pursue regime change on the peninsula.
Yeah. Defense Secretary James Mattis warned of a massive military response to any threat from North Korea against the United States or its allies. How does that sit with you?
I think that's the relatively appropriate messaging coming from a defense secretary. You want to make it clear that were North Korea to attack South Korea or attack Japan or attack the United States, in any way, start a war, that there would be a massive response. What you don't want to do is inadvertently think that you're going to take some kind of preventive action and perhaps accidentally cause them to miscalculate or trigger them to start would have devastating consequences no matter what. The end game here is no war on the North Korean Peninsula and securing a path towards denuclearization in the future. And it's really not a time for reckless rhetoric. So I don't think it's terrible for military officials in the United States, Japan, Korea to say, hey, if you guys start something, we're going to finish it and do it decisively to try to deter them from taking any steps. But at the same time, what you don't want to do is confuse them into thinking we might do something first. I mean, we must not be the ones to start a war on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah. But it is a massive military response even feasible? Wipe out millions of people?
Yeah, if we got to that point, it would be the most devastating conflict on the face of the earth since World War II. There is a massive military response. Anything is feasible. It would be absolutely catastrophic, and it would be something that no one should ever want to see. But the bottom line is that you can't. We don't want to be in a position to be encouraging North Korea to continue its destabilizing provocations. So that's not a threat to start a massive military action. That is just, the Secretary of Defense saying, if you guys, South Korea, this is going to result in a catastrophic war and it's going to result in your destruction. That's a That's not an unreasonable message coming from the military. What is unreasonable is the fire and fury kind of comments we're hearing from the President of the United States, the idea that we will, we'll take actions that it seems like we really won't be willing or able to take. So, I mean, this is a really complicated and difficult situation. North Korea having a hydrogen bomb, be able to eventually place on an ICBM that could reach the United States, something that should be really worrying to everybody. We're going to prevent it. It's going to be prevented through some kind of diplomatic process. Preventing it militarily is both unfeasible, they already seem to have a functioning hydrogen bomb, and would simply be too costly. So we are, and we should be, deterred from starting a conflict on the peninsula.
I'm going to jump in. I'm going to see if we can quickly redial your phone line, as we are losing you every other word or so. And I hope we can get a better connection. We are talking with Vikram Singh, who is the Senior Advisor for National Security, Democracy, and Technology for the Center for American Progress. He authored a recent piece for the Center for American Progress, Don't Let Trump Start a War with North Korea. And we will talk more with him about that when we get him back. And we are welcoming your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I think we have our guest back. Vikram, you did co-author this piece, Don't Let Trump Start a War with North Korea. Do you think this administration is serious about taking military action against North Korea, or is this a fire and fury type talk from President Trump just saber-rattling?
Well, I hope it's saber-rattling, but I think it's unwise saber-rattling. I mean, we've reached a point now where it seems to a lot of people, you know, hey, we've tried sanctions, and now the only other there's this sort of choice between diplomacy that's failed, and President Trump has said things like that. The time for talk is over. They don't understand, you know, they only understand one thing, statements like that. And those are really dangerous kinds of ways to approach this challenge. The fact is there are probably 10 or 20 steps between now and any kind of military option. And I think one of the things we need to do a better job as a country is making sure that we focus on being not being the ones to start wars, being the ones to end wars, and being the ones to try to secure peace and find ways forward on really difficult problems. I don't think it's in anybody's interest to, you know, spark the conflict that might happen on the Korean Peninsula, and I don't think it's helpful for the United States to act like there aren't diplomatic options. There are almost always diplomatic options, and diplomacy might fail. Kim Jong-un might do something suicidal, like attack his neighbors. But assuming he doesn't do that, it's incumbent upon us to figure out a way forward that preserves the peace.
You know, we will talk about the 8-piece long-term strategy that you wrote about in your piece in just a moment. But let me take a call before break. Kyle in Muskego is with us. Hi, Kyle.
Hi. My question is, North Korea for decades have shown they have no appreciation for basic human rights, just in the simple way that they treat their own people and the human rights violations that occur in their own country. And right now, they're basically holding South Korea hostage. The big excuse as to why we can't go in there is because thousands of people would die from conventional artillery attacks from North Korea that we couldn't stop should we act. What happens when they get conventional nuclear weapons that they can aim at U.S. cities and kill millions? Are we going to let them march into South Korea and commit the same atrocities and human rights violations that they're committing on their own people right now because, again, they're holding an American city hostage, like they're holding South Korea hostage. When do we do something about this?
We have less than a minute. When do we do something about this?
I think unfortunately, the caller is exactly right. This is one of the most brutal, cruel regimes on planet Earth, and they have held South Korea, they've held Seoul at risk for decades. This is nothing new. We have been deterred for decades from doing anything, you know, proactive to change the situation that has persisted on the peninsula since the 1950s, largely because the North Koreans can create large-scale destruction in Seoul, not tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands would die. And that is a cost that I think is too high for the South Koreans to bear and too high for us to bear.
I'm going to get news next, and then we'll be back. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Vikram Singh, who is the Senior Advisor for National Security, Democracy, and Technology for the Center for American Progress. He co-authored the recent piece, Don't Let Trump Start a War with North Korea. We're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your thoughts on what the U.S. should do in response to North Korea continuing to flex its nuclear muscle after its sixth nuclear weapons test over the weekend, a hydrogen bomb. North Korea is promising more gift packages for the United States. And reportedly, it looks like they're preparing for another test, perhaps as early as this weekend. So what do you think? What questions do you have? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So James on Facebook says China and Russia are actually proposing a reasonable solution. North Korea suspends its nuclear and long-range ballistic missile programs in exchange for the U.S. and South Korea suspending joint military exercises. So, Vikram, what do you think of that proposal?
So that's been an idea that's been floated out there for quite a while, especially by the Chinese. They're fairly big fans of this. I think it's kind of a non-starter in the sense that I don't think that that's actually going to result in North Korea wanting to freeze their program. It would have to be discussions with them to see if that was really viable. And two, I don't think it's really it's quite a sensible trade. I mean, conducting defensive exercises with our allies in the face of North Korea being the one that's launching missiles and testing nukes and being the one that's threatening. We've never threatened North Korea until Donald Trump with fire and fury in any way. North Korea is the country that regularly says they're going to turn New York or Washington into a sea of fire. So I think being clear that you're going to have strong defensive capabilities and stand closely with your allies is actually a very important piece of deterring North Korea from doing anything reckless, making it sure they see, hey, we have a lot of capabilities. So I don't think it's a particularly smart trade. That said, I also don't think that we should be having sort of preemptive negotiations in the public square. I think that the driver here should be, okay, Russia and China, if you think you have potential deals in the making, get the North Koreans to the table. They have not managed to do that. And the fact is that North Korea's economy has been growing in the last couple of years and that their nuclear and missile programs have been advancing rapidly and that 90%+ of their trade, inbound stuff is coming through China and about 50% of their exports go to Russia. And so Russia and China are sustaining the North Korean regime. And rather than just offer easy-sounding solutions, they need to figure out how they get the North Koreans into a serious dialogue.
What about President Trump saying maybe the U.S. should suspend trade with countries that deal with North Korea? What would that do?
So once again, I actually think there should be in a targeted way. And this is where we've seen sort of a sloppy approach to this by the administration. We're not really going to suspend all trade with China. I mean, unless you want to basically cause a massive economic catastrophe globally and for the American people. Just imagine if tomorrow you switched off trade with China. Well, I mean, that's going to empty the shelves in Walmarts all across the country. That's going to shut down lots of American businesses. It's going to cost lots of American jobs. And so it's an unreasonable, unrealistic threat. And it makes it less likely that world leaders are going to actually take the president at his word when he sort of flies off with these loose threats. Now, the idea that we might sanction companies that do business with North Korea, Chinese or Russian or anybody's companies that are doing business with North Korea, that's actually sensible. And getting specific, which is one of the sections of our short report, getting specific in particular with China about what we want to see, what sectors we expect to see a clampdown on because we think they'll have the biggest impact on the North Koreans, that is smart. Broad, unrealistic threats that, you know, and bluffing where your bluff is going to be called within a minute, that is really not helpful. It really undermines U.S. credibility in a high-stakes situation.
Yeah, in your piece, you did call for an 8-piece long-term strategy, but we aren't going to be able to get to all 8. You said that the U.S. should strengthen alliances and get specific with China. You also called for Congress getting involved. What do you want Congress to do?
Well, so in one sense, Congress has already done one good thing, which was Congress passed a pretty broad sanctions bill that included North Korea, included Russia and Iran sanctions as well, and that's good. I think that one of the things we seem to need Congress to do, which is unfortunate, is to demand that the administration articulate its strategy. So Congress can use its oversight power to call up the Secretary of Defense, call up the Secretary of State, and basically say, tell us what your strategy is, and hopefully force the administration, which has a lot of capable people in it, but doesn't yet seem to have a good enough game plan here, force them to get real about what that game plan is, and force them to be transparent with the American people about the risks we face and what they're going to be doing. We are a democracy, after all, and so Donald Trump's desire to keep everything secret really doesn't sit well with me in terms of being a democratic society. Even in matters of war and peace, there are tactical things and intelligence things that have to be secret. But what our overall game plan is should be something that the American people know something about when we're at such risk.
In addition, you said that the U.S. must attempt to support the North Korean people, not the regime, but the people. How difficult might that be? What would that be?
Well, so here's the interesting thing. So what happened in North Korea over the last several years is Kim Jong-un has gotten rid of all his potential enemies. He's assassinated a powerful uncle. He assassinated his half-brother in the international airport in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And he's at the same time made sure that the elite in North Korea, the people he really would depend on for power, have had a better and better life. So they have more luxury goods, they have more access to telecommunications, they've basically been able to live a pretty good life, and things have overall been improving thanks to China and Russia. The challenge is putting the squeeze on those elites and putting pressure on him and minimizing the damage that can be done to poor rural North Koreans or average North Korean workers. And so that comes from cutting off luxury goods, from cutting off energy supplies at a certain level, from there's ways to target sanctions activities to really cut off North Korea's access to international financial systems, things that are going to hurt the elite more than they'll hurt the people. So it's hard. Sanctions are kind of a blunt instrument, and regimes that don't care about their people often take that out mostly on their people. But the average North Korean isn't drinking Coca-Cola or fine red wine. The North Korean elite is, and they're going to be frustrated with Kim Jong-un if they start to lose some of those perks. And so that's a good way to increase pressure on him.
We have less than a minute. How hopeful are you that this situation with North Korea is ultimately going to end well, or are you deeply troubled about where this is going?
Well, so I'm deeply troubled because I don't know that we know how stable Kim Jong-un is. I think he is deterrable, like any other leader would be, that he doesn't want to start something and see the end of his regime come out of it. But I'm also deeply troubled that we may inadvertently spark a miscalculation. We should be being very careful in our rhetoric and our policies and what we convey. We don't want to provoke him into making a bad choice. And so the thing that would make me more calm is a very clear, consistent approach out of the administration, clear, consistent talking points from secretaries of defense and state and the president and the White House, and a clear game plan for, like, hey, we're going to work towards a freeze, we're going to work to get back to the table, and we're going to try to ratchet down tensions here, because we have a reality on the ground, which is a young guy with nuclear weapons who is clearly trying to say, don't mess with me. So let's not be the ones to start the war. You know, I think it's really important that the United States not be in the position of making things more unstable. So I'm worried. I think it is manageable. I think it's going to be unpleasant because I don't think it's likely that Kim Jong-un's going to give up his nuclear weapons in a hurry. You know, but what we've dealt with these things, the world deals with nuclear armed nations in a lot of different contexts. And if we're just sort of calm and have resolve and are clear, it's something we can handle.
Thank you very much for being with us. Vikram Singh, Vice President for National Security and International Policy for the Center for American Progress. And now we will talk with another guest with another perspective on how the U.S. should respond to North Korea. Our next guest is Eric Gomez, a policy analyst for defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. His research focuses on U.S. military strength in East Asia, missile defense systems, and their impact on strategic stability and nuclear deterrence issues in East Asia. His recent commentary for the Cato Institute, titled Kim Jong-un Leaves an Opening for De-escalation, Should the United States Take It? Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being with us. So how worried should Americans be about the potential threat, especially nuclear threat, coming from North Korea?
Well, I think, unfortunately, I think that we should be more worried over time because, you know, with the latest nuclear test, for example, I don't really consider it to be too much of a game changer because North Korea already tested an ICBM that could reach the United States, and the ability to do that, the ability to hit the United States was in many ways more important than how much damage any missile could do. But it just seems like the longer that we're in this cycle of North Korean action, U.S. reaction, under the Trump administration, the more likely it seems that we're going to keep on doing the sort of maximum pressure strategy, right, where we're going to put on more sanctions, we're going to focus on military posturing, and we're going to not really be very open to any sort of negotiation. And I think the problem with that is that the longer we wait, the harder it will be for us to actually get what we want at the negotiation table, and the more stark our choices become as North Korea overcomes various technical hurdles. So it'll be harder to sort of negotiate for like a limited thing, like a freeze. And the more, you know, you have to contend with the really big thorny questions that I don't think we really are prepared to engage on yet.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said yesterday that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would rather have his people eat grass than give up his nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any way that North Korea would stop its weapons development?
At this point, they've sort of crossed so many hurdles that it'd be difficult to see how. I think the sort of argument for the limited proposal, right, or a sort of halfway proposal would be to get them to cease development of certain types of technology. For example, solid fuel missile technology, because solid fuel missiles can be launched much more quickly than liquid fueled, and the better their arsenal is if they have solid fuel. But a couple weeks ago, Kim Jong-un went to a solid fuel manufacturing facility and showed off that North Korea has the technical means to start producing this stuff at a much higher rate than I think was previously assumed. So I think, the longer we wait, the harder it will be to sort of get like an interim step that could turn into something bigger. I think trying to do a really, really big negotiation at this point would be very difficult.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley told the U.N. Security Council this week that North Korea is, in her words, begging for war, and that while we don't want to go down that road, our country's patience is not unlimited. So what's your reaction to that assessment from Haley?
Well, I think it will encourage North Korea to just cling ever more tightly to their weapons program and keep developing them. You know, threat for feeling that your survival is threatened is a pretty great way to get a program off the ground and to get invest resources in solving that problem. So, for example, people wonder, well, how can North Korea develop such great technology if it can't have a decent economy in any other sense? And I think it's because they're investing almost all of their resources into developing nuclear weapons and delivery systems, because that is the insurance policy. That is the thing that keeps the United States out.
Let me take a call from Bernie in Elkhorn. Hi, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. The guest is right on. I've heard Bruce Cummings, an expert on the Koreas, interviewed many times, and I heard him recently talk about North Korea simply wanting to defend itself. The United States has a history of invading and occupying countries on lies. They were put on the axis of evil, so-called, from George Bush, which was a completely ridiculous statement, and that sparked a lot of fear. And they have a historical memory. The Korean War killed a lot of North Koreans, millions, and it leveled that country. And that was a war of aggression that our country started. They don't forget that. And this ridiculous Nikki Haley warmongering, it just reminds me of the things that have happened under Democratic and Republican administrations, whether it was about Libya or Iraq and all the saber rattling. I think we should assure North Korea we're not going to attack them. They have promised not to attack anyone else or the United States, but our government has not made a similar promise.
So is that it? North Korea just wants to defend itself, Eric?
I think so. I think nuclear weapons are pretty defense-dominant weapons, and that, you know, North Korea threatening to use them first is really, it's not a credible threat for them to just sort of attack out of the blue, because there's no way they could actually disarm the United States, and then they would be open themselves to retaliation. So North Korea's nuclear strategy depends on threatening to use their weapons early on in a conventional conflict. And they, in that sort of nuclear strategy that they're coming out with statements by top officials over time, it seems as if they would not use their nuclear weapons unless they felt that an attack by the United States was imminent or had already sort of begun. So in that sense, you know, the offensive part of that statement is that they would use their nuclear weapons first. The defensive part is under the condition of we detect an attack coming. So that's why Trump's statements of sort of fire and fury, and I think the Secretary Mattis made a sort of vague statement over the weekend where he said that we could respond to any threat by North Korea. The problem is, like, if you start setting those very general sort of terms for what
I got to jump in because we have news next, and then we'll continue after news. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Well, after North Korea tested its biggest nuclear weapon ever over the weekend, Defense Secretary James Mattis warned of a massive military response to any threat from North Korea against the United States or its allies. Then, in response to that, North Korea threatened to send more gift packages to the United States. And it looks as though it is preparing for another test. So we are talking with a guest about how the U.S. should respond to this nuclear threat. And we are welcoming your questions and your thoughts, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Eric Gomez is our guest, policy analyst for defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. His recent commentary was titled, Kim Jong-un leaves an opening for de-escalation. Should the United States take it? You wrote that after North Korea backed off of the threat to shoot missiles near Guam.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote that that left an opening for de-escalation. What kind of an opportunity are you talking about?
So I mostly framed it through the North Korean statement was very around that time, you know, with Guam, was very explicit about that it was a response to U.S. B-1B bomber flights out of North Korea, and also there was concern about the upcoming Ulchi Freedom Guardian big military exercise between the United States and South Korea. And I sort of walked through in that piece, what would be the sort of costs and benefits to either freezing B-1 flights, the United States freezing B-1 flights, or toning down some aspects of the military exercise to sort of extend a little bit of an olive branch to North Korea and say, all right, we hear that this is what is concerning you, that we could sort of make those adjustments on our end for relatively low cost because, you know, it's not like just freezing them for a little while or toning back the military exercise would significantly hurt our ability to deter North Korea, but it would be a low-cost concession the United States could make to see how North Korea would react. And I'm not sure if – I think the administration sort of took the wrong lesson from that. I think they sort of just said, oh, North Korea backed off its threat, and then we didn't really do anything to tone down the exercise or do anything with the B-1 flights. There was a little bit of a lull in North Korean activity, and then you had, you know, the overfly of Japan and then the nuclear test recently. So I think the administration misread North Korea. I don't think that they took any threats off the table. I think they were just making plans and sort of putting the ball in our court to see what the U.S. would do. And then when the U.S. didn't really change its behavior, North Korea decided to, well, okay, we'll just resume our behavior.
Yeah. So are you advocating that the U.S. Do make concessions to North Korea and stop some of the U.S. military actions in the region?
Well, I think if you want to sort of solve this problem without going into conflict, you sort of have to. Look at the Iran deal, for example. The U.S. made several concessions in that, and so did Iran. You know, so both sides had to give up some things that they wanted in order to get the final agreement, and ultimately I think the world is better off for it. So I think, you know, in my piece when I talk about freezing the B-1 flights, for example, the North Koreans have a very skewed threat perception of the B-1. They think that bomber is nuclear capable, and when we do those flights up to South Korea, that we're practicing, like, striking targets in North Korea with nuclear weapons. But then B-1 can't carry nuclear weapons. And I think we can use this to our advantage, right? If they have a threat perception that's out of line with reality, then us agreeing to sort of freeze flights in return for some sort of beginning of talks, for example, could be a way to mollify a fear that they have at a very low impact to our ability to deter them.
Yeah. By changing our behavior, isn't that essentially showing North Korea that North Korea can push us around by firing missiles around?
I think that is the most common critique of such an approach, and I think that, you know, that it certainly has some validity to it. I would say that, you know, taking a sort of tactical step backward on the part of the United States and to use it to see how North Korea reacts could provide a lot of important information about North Korean behavior and calculations while being a low risk for the United States. So I think that, yes, the big hit to the United States could come from the perception that you just mentioned, but I think that we stand to gain more than we stand to lose. And so I think that's why, you know, that calculation has to be a part of our decision-making.
Yeah. Matt in Wausau emailed. He says, as the only nation in the world to use nuclear weapons, we have no right to dictate how others use them. It is hypocritical to have thousands of nuclear warheads and dictate who else can have them. So should the U.S. just say, okay, it's North Korea, we don't mind if you are, you know, have a missile that can reach the United States?
Well, I think the political sort of calculus behind not saying that out loud is that we worry about proliferation in the region, right? And to sort of say, okay, I think the argument is that if you view that as a sort of capitulation in North Korea's nuclear status, and if you give up on the goal of denuclearization, then that could encourage other countries in the region like Japan or South Korea to develop their own nuclear weapons. And I think that's a reasonable concern, and I would certainly like to see fewer nuclear weapons in the world in general. So I think that's the reason. But I think it's important to acknowledge the kind of de facto reality, right? And maybe you don't call North Korea a legitimized nuclear weapons state out loud, but you sort of, the U.S. government goes ahead and sort of just accepts that in the near term, at least. Denuclearization is essentially off the table, and we need to focus on ways of crisis management right now and ways of de-escalating the sort of war of words and action-reaction cycle that could really lead to a problem.
Let's go to Scott in Whitewater. Hello, Scott.
Good morning. Here's my question for you. I like to look at history, whatever, and when back in the first Gulf War, whatever, the Iraqi Republican Guard were made out to be this elite fighting force that couldn't be stopped and so on and so forth. Do we have any indication, whatever, from a conventional standpoint, how the North Korean army is? Will they just, like, fall over and wave the white flag, kind of like what the Republican Guard did during the first Iraqi war back in the early 90s?
How strong is the conventional North Korean military, Eric? Do you know?
I think that it's difficult to tell. It's difficult to tell how an army will sort of perform in a wartime, you know, before the war actually starts. On the conventional capability side, so speaking to just like their military technology and not their fighting sort of spirit or will to fight, the North Korean military is rather large, and in terms they have like an old air defense network, but it's very heavily layered, so it would take a lot of time to probably tear that down. They have, a relatively small navy and a relatively, large ground force. And it's definitely an old military, but they so I think the size is the primary problem. On the fighting spirit willpower question, it's difficult to say if they'll sort of fold or if they'll keep going. But I think that to assume that they would fold would be a mistake. I think that we need to assume that they would stand and fight, even if Kim Jong-un were killed early in a conflict. If we're talking just like raw size and in terms of an insurgency and post-conflict stabilization efforts, then I think North Korea is a really hard case because of its, just intense levels of poverty and also just the sheer size of armed forces out there. It would be very difficult to, I think, pacify the entire country were a conflict to happen.
Yeah. After a North Korean non-nuclear test last Wednesday, President Trump tweeted, the U.S. has been talking to North Korea and paying them extortion money for 25 years. Talking is not the answer. So maybe as we're kind of wrapping up here, what is the answer, Eric?
I think the answer was the answer that we got sort of in the 1990s, which was the agreed framework negotiated by the Clinton administration, which was an imperfect agreement, but it definitely bought time And yes, the North Koreans were caught cheating, but they were caught, like, right? And there was a mechanism sort of to deal with that. And then when the framework was abandoned in the 2000s, then they rushed to test a nuclear weapon. And so now here we are. And I think that this view that, you know, you don't negotiate with countries like North Korea is not a good view to have, right? Like, Reagan was willing to negotiate with the Soviet Union about arms control and reducing tensions with them. You know, the U.S. has to negotiate with countries that we don't like and with countries that threaten us. And I think, you know, our point of maximum leverage is over. So now our options are talk sooner rather than later or get really worse outcomes down the road that are even harder to sort of walk back with talks. So if I could, you know, send any message to the administration, I'd say, you know, stop making vague threats, start making specific ones that deter North Korean actions, not just words, because you're not going to deter their words. And, you know, start seriously considering what can we talk about, what would be on the table, are there any sort of small concessions that wouldn't actually hurt us too much to make, to see how they react, and get to talking. It doesn't mean that we have to end sanctions, right? I think that both need to be part of it. It's important to have pressure, but also a mechanism to relieve pressure. And the problem is we don't have any mechanism to relieve pressure right now besides demanding that the North Korea just, like, completely capitulate to our interests, and they're not going to do that.
Yeah, we have less than a minute. How hopeful are you that tensions with North Korea will ultimately simmer down?
I'm not very confident under this current administration, just because when North Korea acts, I think the proclivity of the Trump administration is to keep on dialing up the pressure. And I understand what their theory of victory is, but I don't think it's going to work. So I think the action-reaction cycle is going to continue. And I would hope that, you know, let's not move any sort of large groups of military assets into the South Korean area in relatively short notice, because that could really get Kim's trigger or fingers on the trigger.
Thank you very much for being with us. Eric Gomez is with the Cato Institute. Thanks to Bill Martens and Akili Boltina for producing this program. This is the Ideas Network.